He was an all-star on the blue line. He was a donut entrepreneur. He was a good old North Ontario boy, and he was tough as nails for sure. 'Cause there once was a day when the Maple Leafs didn't have to take the flak. Brought the cup home in 62 and just kept on bringing it back. But I'm really just a casual observer.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Canuck as a Slur, the podcast about cool and cursed Canadian content. My name is Nicole, and with me to traumatize me today is Kelly.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, not so bad. I'm a little nervous about what you've got.
And why are you nervous?
Because the only context you've given me is that it's going to knock my socks off.
Yep.
Which I suppose could be a good thing, but I feel like we've been friends long enough that I'm nervous. That terminology made me nervous.
I don't think you get enough credit for not only how much you do for this show, which is your show, which you host.
Yes, of course.
But everyone also knows that. For what a good friend you are, because you have come all the way from Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
You are here in the country for only a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You really only get to see me for like one day. And I said, can we spend the entire time recording a podcast? And I won't tell you what it's about.
Yeah, that's fair. I didn't tell you this, but we just flew into town just for this. I flew, 10 hours. There's an 8-hour time difference. So I got 8 hours worth of jet lag just to fly in for this recording. I actually have another show back in Switzerland in 13 hours. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we should dive into it. So today, the subject that we're talking about, it started as I thought, we're just going to do a real quick thing, like maybe 1 hour podcast in and out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pick someone that's a little obscure and just kind of do a little summary of their life.
Is that me? Am I the one that's a little obscure?
Yeah, the episode is about you and your impact on society.
That might not knock my socks off.
Yeah. Well, I told you it would.
You did. You did warn me.
What I did was I picked this character and I kind of found, you know how these things go, where you start with one story and you end up with a completely different one. So where our story starts, as you can imagine, is with hockey.
That checks out for you. Yep.
Nicole, how do you feel about hockey?
I have mixed feelings about it. I feel like I am not much of a sports person, but I do love being around people that enjoy sports when sports things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a joiner, but I'm not a hockey fan.
Right. See, me personally, I think hockey is stupid and dumb. I've never liked it. I can't even remember the last time I watched it.
That sounds accurate.
Yeah. I think if people who like or care about hockey are massive losers. And like, honestly, personally, I think winning the Stanley Cup, that sounds like fucking embarrassing. Like, you'd hate to win the Stanley Cup.
Oh, absolutely. Like, yeah. I'm so happy about the turnout of the game last night.
Was there a game outcome last night?
There was, actually.
I didn't know. I wouldn't know because I don't care. It's fine.
I read about it somewhere.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know who was playing.
I don't know, some cats and some circles.
Yeah, never heard of them.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about a hockey player today. So have you heard of Miles Gilbert Horton?
I have not.
Okay.
Is he the guy that heard of who?
He is, yeah. You've spoiled all my reveals, but he is the player who first heard of who. And we're going to tell the story about that. And it's an interesting figure because he's fallen into obscurity, but was kind of a big deal at the time and had like kind of an outsized impact, but we'll get to that. So Miles Gilbert Horton was born on January 12th, 1930 in Cochrane, Ontario. His father, Aaron, who named him after his two grandfathers, was a CN railway mechanic. I couldn't find a source that said so explicitly, but I think it's reasonable to guess that this sort of a career might be the reason you have to move your family around a little bit. Regardless of why, though, in 1936, they would find themselves packing up and heading to Duparquet, Quebec, thus completing early our constitutional requirement to mention Quebec in every episode.
Oh, is Canada's boyfriend going to be in this episode?
Well, he has to be in every episode. We have to connect everyone to him, so.
You gotta, and also connect Quebec for some reason?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, mostly the show is about Quebec and hockey.
Okay.
It was here that young Miles would first learn to play hockey, although the clan would move again during his childhood, first back to Cochrane and then to Sudbury, Ontario.
Mm.
From there, he would be scouted by the Toronto Maple Leafs, who placed him within their farm system. For a few years, he built his skill set as a versatile, tough defender and made his NHL debut on March 26, 1950, although he would play mostly in the AHL through the end of the following season, helping them win the Calder Cup in 1952 before making the Leafs full-time the ensuing fall. He then played 18 seasons in Toronto, including an impressive run of 486 consecutive regular season games between 1961 and 1968. This stood as the NHL record among defensemen until 2007, when it was broken by Latvian blue liner Karlis Skrostins. Throughout his career, Miles was praised by many of his opponents as being the strongest in the league. Gordie Howe called him the strongest player in hockey. Noted serial domestic abuser and erstwhile NHL player Bobby Hull had this to say, "I figured I was a pretty strong guy after a summer of work on my farm. Then I'd go against him." In another instance, Hull said, "There were defensemen you had to fear because they were vicious and would slam you into the boards from behind, for one, Eddie Shore. But you respected him because he didn't need that type of intimidation. He used his tremendous strength and talent to keep you in check."
Oh, is check a thing that happens in hockey? I thought that was a chess thing.
I'm not giving you anything on that.
You want to cut that joke? You're just preparing on how to edit it out?
I'm going to give you a few visual aids in this one. So I want to show you what the strongest player in hockey looked like, and you tell me if you kind of believe it.
It's the guy on the right.
It is the one on the right.
Okay, it's not the dog.
No.
Okay. Was there an airbutt on hockey? I feel like I buy that guy's the toughest guy in hockey.
Yeah, I think there was a hockey airbutt.
I think so, too. There was definitely a movie called Most Valuable Primate, MVP.
Yes.
That was also about hockey. That was a
that might be what I'm thinking of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dog on skates is a bit silly. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I do believe that this jarhead-looking motherfucker is the strongest guy in hockey.
Jarhead-looking motherfucker, that's a good one.
Hmm.
Now, I'm glad you didn't make any salacious comments about him, because do you want to guess how old he is in this picture?
He's got the face of like a 40-year-old.
He sure does.
Like, he's seen some shit. Is he like 18 or something?
He is 16.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh my God. What kind of life did this guy live that he looks like he lived that hard at 16?
Yeah. He's a good old tough Ontario boy.
Good Lord.
Yeah. This picture has gone around on Reddit. One of the comments was like, the only person who looks 16 in the photo is the dog.
Yeah. That's accurate. Yeah, he looks like he's been working in coal mines his entire life.
Yeah.
Like he's supporting 8 kids during the Great Depression.
Yeah. So for anyone who's just listening, like it's, you know, you're kind of describing he's got a bit of that like 40-year-old look to his face. Like he's also fucking yoked, in case that wasn't clear.
Yeah.
Like absolutely. Like when I was 16, you know what? I totally looked like that. And I do now. If you're just listening on audio, we are both just fucking absolutely bursting at the seams of swoleness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate how your head just tapers directly into your shoulders. It's looking good.
So just to drive the point home, here's a quick summary from an article in the Hockey Writers on how other players saw him. Quote, "He was widely considered one of the strongest, toughest players in the NHL, whether you were playing with him or against him. This earned him the nickname Superman, coined by legendary Toronto Maple Leafs goaltender and longtime teammate of his, Johnny Bauer. Bauer believed Miles could lift a 40-gallon oil drum over his head without actually ever seeing him complete this feat. Fellow Leafs legend and teammate Dave Keon once recalled him throwing railroad ties around like they were toothpicks."
Jesus. Okay, so, sorry, Bauer, is that the guy that the hockey equipment is named after?
No, it's B-O-W-E-R.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I was waiting for, like, the extremely stupid joke you were going to go for that I was also just going to no-sell you on.
That's fair. Yeah. How dare you? First of all, I've never made a stupid joke in my life.
No, of course
I
not.
I only make highbrow, high-end content.
Yeah. So, continuing to read from the same piece, perhaps more unbelievable than that was Leafs defenseman Bob Bond's recounting of an instance when he saw Miles lift barrels of cement and barricade an intersection in Quebec.
This feels like very like urban legend-y.
A little bit. Like there's no context for why he's throwing around railroad ties or, you know, barricading an intersection.
Yeah.
But we are being asked to believe this, yeah.
He sounds like Big John from that, is it Johnny Cash song? Big Bad John.
I couldn't tell you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know the song that I mean though, right?
No, I don't.
Oh, dang. Okay. Yeah.
You want to sing the whole thing for me?
Yeah. let's just record me singing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, absolutely not.
The same article extends the Superman comparison by mentioning his thick-framed glasses, which he only wore off the ice despite his significant nearsightedness that only worsened as his career wore on. Further, despite his oft-attested strength, by all accounts, he was not considered a dirty player. Here's another sample from the same article describing Miles' signature move. Quote, during a game in his rookie season, Boston Bruins center Derek Sanderson slashed him while forechecking in the offensive zone and proceeded to do it again, earning the bear hug that was about to come his way. So this is a quote within the quote. He put the bear hug on me and started to squeeze, said Sanderson. I heard my ribs groan and thought they were all going to crack. It really started to hurt, and then he let go and tossed me on my back like a towel. I never slashed him or challenged him again.
That's kind of a cute way to disarm someone that's being a shit on the ice.
Yeah.
Although, as soon as he said I heard my ribs crack, it like gave me PTSD because I was like, my brother used to do that as like a non-aggressive aggressive. Yeah, like it's not, I wouldn't say it's like dangerous, but it like my older brother would always like do shit like that where he would like go to grab your hand and like shake it, but like squeeze it too hard or like do that thing where you roll the knuckles.
Oh, I fucking hated that.
The worst.
Oh.
Where it seems innocuous, but it actually is painful. And then yeah, bear hugs were his other thing.
So it just finishes by saying, he might be Clark Kent off the ice, but as Sanderson learned, it's better not to mess with Superman on the ice.
Yeah, awesome. Superman, famously known for his hugging move.
Yeah. Across his long career, Miles played in 7 NHL All-Star games, had his number retired by 2 teams, made the list of the top 100 players ever by both the Hockey News and the NHL itself, in addition to being inducted in the Hall of Fame, was voted the 59th greatest Canadian in the 2004 CBC contest, and won 4 Stanley Cups during his tenure with the Toronto Maple Leafs in the 1960s, presumably setting a winning precedent to be followed by the franchise for generations to come.
Okay.
As much as his physicality impressed his opponents, his character impressed his teammates. Sal Majorana, writing in the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, interviewed some of them in a 2024 article. I think of him every day of my life, Mike Robitaille, who played 3.
Oh my God. Yeah. He's the one that got away.
In many ways, yeah. I think of him every... This is just the beginning of the quote, okay? We got to get to the whole quote.
Is the rest of it just as sweet? Because I think, yes, I might start crying.
Listen, I think of him every day of my life, Mike Robitaille, who played 3+ seasons for Buffalo and later spent 3 decades as Sabres broadcaster, told me with a very apparent lump in his throat, he has never left my mind. He made the biggest impact in my life of anyone I've ever been involved with in hockey. He never taught me a damn thing verbally about hockey, but I learned things from watching him. I learned how to play angles, putting players at bad angles so when they shoot, they can't score. I didn't know any of that stuff early in my career. I became an experienced player because of him. He was everything to me. My mentor. My hero. I idolized him.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
The life and career of Miles Gilbert Horton has been commemorated on everything from statues to postage stamps, and yet, despite all we've talked about, he's hardly remembered as a hockey player at all. To understand why, we have to dive into another story, one that goes back at least as far as the mid-19th century, when the ancient human tradition of creating fried bread... When the ancient human tradition of creating fried bread snacks led to the advent of the beloved modern donut.
Okay. I was wondering, actually, after I made the Horton Here's a Who joke, I was like, wait a minute, but his first name isn't Tim.
No, it's not. It's Miles Gilbert Horton.
Okay. Where did the Tim come from? I guess we'll find out.
Well,
we won't find out. I can tell from your face.
You're assuming this is Tim Horton.
Okay, sorry, continue. Maybe I'll be surprised.
Let's turn to the Smithsonian Magazine recounting the dedication ceremony of a new special donut exhibit at the Fame Museum to learn about that. Quote, a singer, Cindy Hutchins, stepped up to the mic and, drawing on the museum's archive of popular sheet music, more than a million songs in all, sang, who made the donut with a hole in the middle? Just how it got there will always be a riddle. Well, yes and no. It is true that the humble donut does have a convoluted past that involves Dutch immigrants, Russian exiles, French bakers, Irving Berlin, Clark Gable, and a certain number of Native Americans. And yes, in its democratic ethos, its optimism, and its assorted origins, it does seem rather quintessentially American.
I'm curious about how all those things go together to make the donut, yeah, but I don't know if we have time to talk about it.
It's democratic ethos.
Democratic ethos.
Have you noticed how Americans love to claim anything? It's like, yeah, apple pie, that's ours. Donut, it's ours. You know, the baseball, they can have baseball, but like, I don't know.
I don't know. I think donuts just belong to cops all around the world. They don't. It's not necessarily just American ones.
That is true.
Boop, boop, boop. Sorry, I'm booping Toshi.
Yeah, is he on the camera? No, he's just off the camera. That's the problem.
He's sure all over the mic, though.
Yeah. Like, just move your head up. Oh, here he comes. No, he's gone. So in my experience, a lot of origin stories, whether of cuisine, sports, musical genres, anything else with complex histories, are completely apocryphal, as a lot of the innovations are iterative over long periods of time from a wide from a wide variety of influences. But the Smithsonian is willing to stake the claim that both the name and the familiar ring shape trace back to a New England sailor named Captain Hanson Crockett Gregory and his mother Elizabeth. In their telling, Elizabeth made a slightly different version of Dutch oolekoeks, which tended to not cook well through the center, in which she filled the middle with walnuts or hazelnuts, hence donuts.
Mmm.
You'd hate to have to hand it to Wikipedia over the Smithsonian, but their entry for donut alone cites a number of sources that employ the term donut, D-O-W, or doughnut, D-O-U-G-H, from the very beginning of the 19th century. The American Heritage Dictionary states that nut is an archaic form that used to refer to a small rounded cake or cookie, which to me is a lot more plausible.
Okay. I always thought it was donut. I thought that it was talking about the shape of it in that, like a nut and a bolt. Oh, no. Dang it. Never mind. I always mix up what nuts and bolts are, and I was picturing a bolt, or I was picturing a nut.
Yeah. That is a nut. The nut is shaped like that.
Oh. Yes,
that's
okay.
Possibly also where nut comes from in the construction sense, like the little round cookie. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, no, I always thought that it was shaped the same. I thought that it was named after the construction apparatus, the fastener.
I don't think so. I think those are much newer.
Hmm. Interesting.
What are you doing down there, Toshi? One thing that is certain is that Hanson Gregory himself claimed to have innovated the familiar ring shape. Some retellings say he did it as a cost-cutting measure, while others are far more colorful. You notice how I did that away from the mic? Here's an example.
Coward.
Here's an example as presented by Snopes. Gregory was eating a donut made by his mother Elizabeth aboard his ship on a dark night in 1847 when a storm suddenly struck. Gregory, who abruptly needed the use of both of his hands, impaled the donut on the handle of the ship's wheel and steered the boat to safety.
So he stuck it on the thing and then that made the hole? Is that what they're saying? Or it had a hole, and so he was able to slide it over.
No, like he made the hole by impaling it.
Okay, I've watched American Pie. I know what really happened here.
Yeah. So this is a popular enough legend that like there are like drawings of this happening. So you want to, for the audio listeners, do you want to describe the image you see on the screen?
Oh, God. This is an old-timey cartoon of some sailors on a boat. They have some wild facial hair. One guy has that thing where, like, the full-on from Pirates of Penzance, the modern major general with just the beard shaved out and the rest of it growing freely.
Oh, like kind of has, like, neck beardy mutton chop situation.
Yeah, genau.
Yeah.
That was German.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, genau. There's this old, very stressed-looking dude. He is steering the ship, and it looks like he has three hands on each side because he is spinning it. I think that they're trying to show that, like, the wheel's in motion. And then there's a donut right on the center one so that he can eat while steering, I guess.
See, I hadn't considered that. I thought they were just showing him as, like, he's got so many hands on deck that he's just got, like, five or six hands.
This is what they mean when they say all hands on deck?
Yeah. Which, like, I think your way makes sense, because I was like, if the guy had five or possibly six hands, you think he could have just held onto the donut with one of them.
Yeah.
Most people will steer a ship with two hands.
Mm. But this guy's, yeah, no, he's all over it. He's got five, at least, maybe even six if he... Maybe the one's blocked by the other guy's head. But yeah, he looks like he's managing it well, so...
Yeah.
Thank God for that hole in that donut.
Mm-hmm. It's from the man himself, though, that we get what's possibly a more honest version, but absolutely more fun to read, from when the captain was interviewed by the Washington Post as an 85-year-old in 1916.
Mm.
Now, you, I know from our last role-playing adventure, do an excellent ship's captain voice.
Oh, God, so, do I?
Yeah, I have put up the text of this one in our slideshow. So do you want to read this one in your, what was your character's name?
Oh, fuck. I don't do
that. Tanner was Whaleback Willie. Oh, you want to read it in the Helm McKeelstern voice.
Helm McKeelstern. Wait.
Helm McKeelstern.
Helm McKeelstern, of course. I don't remember the Helm McKeelstern voice.
It was like this. It was back. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or just do any sea captain voice. Just
any
go.
Sea captain voice. Okay. It was back. Oh, I don't know just what year. Let me see. Born in 31. Shipped when I was 13. Well, I guess it
You're turning into your Southern Belle a little bit.
I was thinking I was turning more into like starchy.
Starch McCullough.
Starch McCullough.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it was about 47 when I was 16 that I was aboard ship and discovered the hole, which was later to revolutionize the donut industry. Now, in them days, we used to cut the donuts into diamond shapes and also into long strips bent in half and then twisted. I don't think we called them donuts then. They was just fried cakes and twisters. Well, sir, they used to fry all right around the edges. But when
now you're a humble country lawyer.
I can't wait to get all my clients off. Fuck.
Yeah? How do you do that?
By being an excellent lawyer. Yeah. But when you had the edges, fuck me.
Here, let me lead you into it.
Yeah, yeah, give me a pirate.
Now, in them days, we used to cut the donuts into diamond shapes and also into long strips, bent in half and then twisted. I don't think we called them donuts then. They was just fried cakes and twisters. Okay, go.
Oh, damn it, Toshi. Well, sir, holy fuck. Come here. Psst, psst, psst. Yeah, good kitty. Well, sir, they used to fry all right around the edges. That's better. But when you had the edges done, the insides was all raw dough. And the twisters used to sop up all the grease they just where they were bent. And they were tough on the digestion. Well, I says to myself...
No, wait, wait, I want to read that very carefully.
Well, I saws to my... Well, I saws to myself... Why wouldn't a space inside so I've solved the difficulty? I thought at first I'd take one of the strips. Toshi, buddy. He's like right in front
Here,
of
I'll
our
turn
generator.
This monitor and you can just read my version.
Hey, okay. Well, I saw to myself. Why wouldn't a space inside solve the difficulty? I thought at first I'd take one of the strips and roll it around. And then I got an inspiration. A great inspiration. I took the cover off the ship's tin pepper box, and I cut into the middle of that donut the first hole ever seen by mortal eyes. What was that?
That's the story of the donut hole, as told by the sea captain.
Okay. Well, sure. The first hole ever seen by mortal eyes.
Yeah.
All right.
That's how I felt when, can't remember.
Go on. No, go.
Can't remember.
Do it. You can do it. I believe in you. You can make a whole joke.
Let me give you 2/3 of a joke.
Okay.
Not a whole joke.
You didn't even give me 2/3.
That's how I felt when I saw a hole last night.
Ew. The first hole ever seen by mortal eyes.
It had been a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This is a slightly condensed version of the full interview, an archived image of which is also on the Snopes page, and is extremely worth reading in its entirety. Gregory said that he brought the idea back to his mother, and it spread outward from there. There doesn't seem to be much out there to disprove his assertion that he invented the hole, so we'll give it to him. Flash forward to 1964. In this era, hockey players didn't pull in the exorbitant salaries that they do today. Many worked side jobs, especially during the offseason, and Miles was no exception.
So sorry.
Are you sorry?
I'm not. Okay, sorry.
It's going to be fun deciding if I keep those in or not.
Do what you will.
Many worked side jobs, especially during the off-season, and Miles was no exception. The Canadian Encyclopedia summarizes his side hustles thusly. While Horton had picked up summer jobs that include working at Brewer's Retail, the beer store, and Conn Smythe's Gravel Company, that's like the owner of the team, he also had an entrepreneurial spirit that led him to pursue business ventures. These included a hamburger restaurant in Scarborough and a car dealership in Toronto. He and his brother, Jerry, also opened another restaurant, The Big Seven, he wore number seven, in North Bay, Ontario in the 1960s. It would be another eatery, however, that would cement Tim Horton's legacy.
Hey, why are they calling him Tim Horton all of a sudden?
So here's the funny thing. It doesn't say why, but it just says his mom picked Tim. So the reason for Miles and Gilbert was that those were his grandfather's names.
Mm-hmm.
So my kind of like read on this was that he was like, I'm the man and I'll be naming the son after, this is the Ontario accent.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be naming the son after my pappy and your pappy. And that's how we do it around here in Cochrane, Ontario. And his wife was like, okay, yeah, you name him whatever you want. You're the man. Anyway, we're calling him Tim because Miles and Gilbert are shit names. Like,
I feel like I read an Am I the Asshole about this the other day where the husband didn't like nicknamey names and the wife was like, okay, but I kind of do. And so they agreed that they would name the kid in like a regular ass name, but that she was allowed to shorten it. And then he changed his mind, like, after the baby was born, was like, I don't like you calling him that because then other people are going to call him that. So maybe Tim Horton's parents also had their, like, the 1950s version of Am I the Asshole? They, like, posted in the local newspaper.
30s, yeah.
30s. And they're like, am I the asshole for calling my son Tim?
Yeah. So I've noticed that Toshi's butt has been spinning my camera slowly over time. Thanks, dude. You're a big help.
Yeah, I appreciate that he's showing us his butt and, like, walking everywhere that's a fucking nuisance, but he won't show himself on camera.
Yes, I was about to say literally that. Like, he's he's completely all over the entire recording space, but right behind the cameras. And he's like, you fucking dick, Toshi.
He's figured out exactly where to go to be the most nuisance with the least amount of contribution.
Yeah.
Which honestly, same, but hey, Toshi. He's pretty cute. He does make up for it a little bit.
Like, just slide over 1 inch. There you go. You're good.
Toshi looks so content with himself after absolutely having ruined your life.
Yeah, that's what he does. He comes in and ruins my life.
Sounds like being married.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's great, actually. 10 out of 10. Highly recommend retiring and moving to Switzerland.
Yeah. Yeah, how's your novel coming along?
Good. I like got like 30-ish chapters.
Of like just world-building notes?
No, that's Josh.
Oh, okay.
I'm doing some things.
So yeah, this is Tim Horton. His legal name was always Miles Gilbert Horton, but just literally everyone since he was a baby called him Tim.
Okay.
I should note at this point that citations from the Canadian Encyclopedia, which is what we just read from, ought to be taken with a grain of salt. At one point, they state that Tim Horton invented the apple fritter, which he did not.
Who did?
Well, this was another thing where it's like the concept of fritters has existed for a long time. And like it's just sort of a, there's a specific definition of like what makes a fritter. And it's like, yeah, you just put different things like apples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tim Horton did not invent any donuts. And we'll get into that part in a bit. And in fairness, the company itself has also claimed this, but it's not true.
Those sons of bitches.
Yeah.
Wow, a corporation is lying to us for their own benefit?
Yeah.
For clout?
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Who and can you trust
that's
anymore?
Also foreshadowing.
Boy.
But that paragraph I just read is generally verifiable information elsewhere. That dealership, for example, specializes in sports cars, also foreshadowing, and you can see some of the ads here.
Oh.
Yeah, so this is an ad for Tim Horton Motors.
Okay.
There's a picture of Tim Horton and, I don't know, some friend of his, and just a bunch of different like cars from the 60s.
Is he the one on the right again here?
Yeah.
He looks like a goon from a mob movie.
Oh man. Wait till you get into later pictures of him. And here's another ad for Tim Horton Motors. Here, do you want to read this this quote that's actually legible from the ad?
The 62 Lark is a championship car. It's as stingy on gas as Johnny Bauer is on goals. What an asshole. Isn't Johnny Bauer the guy that said that he would never forget Tim Horton and he thinks about him every day?
No, he's the guy who said that he was...
Oh, we gave him the squeeze.
No. Johnny Bauer was his goalie. This is a compliment.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay, that makes a bit... I was like, I thought he was just like fucking for no reason throwing some other hockey player under the bus. And
no.
Being like,
Bauer was the one who believed he could lift a 40-gallon oil drum over his head.
Okay.
And, like, to be completely upfront, every time I said, like, Miles in those quotes, like, they were saying, like, Horton or Tim or something.
Okay.
But I changed them because I'm a liar.
Mm, fair. The 62 Lark is a championship car. It's as stingy on gas as Johnny Bauer is on goals, which is a good thing. And can seat six big players in comfort.
Right in the ad copy. This is a good thing.
I mean, just for people that don't follow hockey, I never would have known that. Can seat six big players in comfort. That's pretty good. They're just like, that's like the Canadian. It's like the American version where you measure everything by football fields.
Yeah, you measure things in big, like 6'3" Ontario boys.
Yeah, burly Ontario boys. Yeah.
This is like Don Cherry selling cars. Like, this car can fit three players, head to toe, 6'3", 230 pounds.
If they're European, they could fit eight.
Yeah, exactly.
The Lark is a rugged competitor, the best in any league. Come on in and let our sales team arrange a test drive for you.
Now Tim Horton's accent is drifting down into some sort of southern twang.
Yeah, everyone in the 60s is just always has a southern twang.
So the cars and the coffee were better connected than you might expect. One of the articles I used as a source on Horton's life, a 2024 story in the Toronto Star, explains. Before owning Tim Horton Motors on Yonge Street, he sold Pontiacs at a Scarborough car lot. One afternoon, he made a sale to Jim Charade, which is exactly like what you want, like a trustworthy salesman to be named.
I was going to say, like, I would not buy a car from that guy.
Yeah. Oh, I guess he's the one buying the car here, but he will become a business guy.
Oh, okay.
Charade owned Your Donut Shop, and here donut is stylized as D-O-N-U-T, so it, to me it looks like do nut.
Do nut.
Yeah, so after like no nut November, you get do nut December.
Oh, that's way better than the joke I was going to make.
Yeah.
I was going to say, do not eat here.
Look, I'll cut two different versions and each of them will have our joke in it and we'll put them on like different feeds and we'll A-B test which joke is better.
Perfect.
Yeah. Charade owned Your Donut Shop on Lawrence Avenue East near Warden. Completing the paperwork, Charade asked Horton to partner with him and open a chain of coffee shops. The pair launched the first Tim Horton Donuts in 1964 in Hamilton on a former Esso gas station site. The partnership lasted a few years before Charade would be replaced by Ron Joyce, who would build a fast food empire.
Were they actually friends, or was it all a charade?
Well, we'll see.
Never mind. I've got an even worse joke, but we can just keep reading this script. Okay.
No, don't worry. We'll cover Ron Joyce, but it'll be a little bit of an ode to Joyce.
Boo.
Yeah. So that's the end of that quote. Joyce became a full partner in the business in 1967, and the fortunes of the chain went nowhere but up. As for Horton himself, well, in 1968-69, a campaign in which he turned 39 years old, the player they called Superman put up 40 regular season points, his highest total ever. And while we're talking about Tim Horton with the Leafs, now that the cat's out of the bag, this is not anything important other than I love how cool these old hockey pictures look with the lighting and no fucking ads anywhere.
Yeah, that is pretty rad. Why are they playing? Why is it so dark?
I think it just had to do with like the way the buildings were lit and how photography worked, that it was just like hard to really like light an area in the same way.
Is there no one in the stands, or can you just not see them because it's dark? And can the people in the stands see what's going on the rink even?
You know, I'm honestly not enough of like a photography historian to tell you.
Okay.
But, you know, sound off in the comments if you know. Also, it's very dumb that they don't have helmets, but it looks great.
It does look pretty cool. Like, the focus on their expressions is pretty good.
The Toronto Maple Leafs, as a team, had a middling performance themselves, losing 4-0 in the first round playoffs against the Boston Bruins, including two opening games in Boston where they were outscored by a combined total of 17-0. This surely puts the series in the top 10 most humiliating defeats the Leafs have ever suffered at the hands of the Bruins. Toronto's coach and general manager, Punch Imlach, who is beloved by...
Sorry, his name was what?
Punch Imlach.
Punch Imlach. Yeah. Cool. Normal.
Now, Punch was a nickname, in fairness.
Okay.
His real name was something stupid like George. I don't know. I'm sorry if your name is George, but...
I'm not.
Toronto's coach and general manager, Punch Imlach, who is beloved by Horton and other older veterans, had long chafed with younger players and let a great deal of talent go. That offseason, the Leafs fired Imlach and Tim Horton announced his retirement. He did not, however, retire. Maple Leafs owner Harold Ballard, and put a pin in that name for a future episode, asked what kind of money it would take for him to return. Horton claimed that his request to double his salary was a joke, but according to later reporting in the Montreal Gazette, that's exactly what he got.
Oh, shit.
He re-signed for a salary of $90,000, although late in the season, he was traded to the New York Rangers.
$90,000. What is that in real money
today. I will pull this up because I have a website for this. So this website, these people who made this website were thinking, okay, we recognize that the value of money changes over time and that you need to constantly calculate what inflation is. So I would imagine that when you make a website like this, you are intending to just have it up indefinitely. So it's useful year over year. Mm-hmm. So the name of the website is in2013dollars.com.
Pardon?
Yeah. So they're like, in 2013, they were like, well, we'll never outgrow the name. Like, we'll never outgrow this URL.
No one will ever need to compare past valuation of the dollar to current valuation of the dollar after this year.
Yeah, definitely not.
Good. Cool.
So $90,000 in 1969 is worth $726,404.07 today.
Jesus.
So that's like league minimum today, basically. But
oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's too high, but yeah. I don't need to soapbox right now. Because yeah. Like 90 grand, that's like a really nice salary nowadays.
Mm-hmm. I'd love 90 grand. That'd be great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm making 0 grand, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but once your book kicks off.
Yeah, for sure.
Once you get your Patreon check for this episode.
It's a guaranteed success, my book.
Mm-hmm. He re-signed for a salary of $90,000, although late in the season he was traded to the New York Rangers, which he was not happy about, calling it, quote, the worst emotional moment of my life, end quote, in part because he did not want to have to uproot his family.
Yeah.
At the conclusion of that campaign, after a first-round playoff loss to the Boston Bruins, he was set to retire for real. Except, well, he didn't. He played another full season with the Rangers before announcing that he was finally done, so they left him unprotected in what was called the intra-league draft, an archaic concept too boring even for my tastes. Similarly, we're going to gloss over the league's doubling in size a few years prior, where they added 6 new teams that struggled to compete with the existing 6. All you need to know is this. When they claimed him, the Pittsburgh Penguins had only existed for 4 seasons, and they were not very good.
Okay. How long did they live in New York?
He played 2 seasons for the New York Rangers.
Okay.
And then he was left eligible for, like, other teams could just pick players that were unprotected from other teams.
Right, because they thought he was going to quit, so they didn't want to waste their time on him.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So the Penguins claim him because they have an ace up their sleeve. Their coach, Red Kelly, which incidentally is the nickname I got that time I fell asleep at the nude beach.
Hey, I thought you were going to make a joke about your trip to Russia.
No. No. Red Kelly was a former teammate of Horton's from Toronto. While the details of the conversations have been lost to history, one way or another, Kelly managed to convince Horton to play just one more season.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you may see a pattern developing
here. This feels like I'm just going to have one more beer situation.
100%. Mm-hmm. That foreshadowing.
Oh.
You may see a pattern developing here. He publicly credited Kelly's persuasiveness, as well as his wife, a Pittsburgh native, for changing his mind. The $100,000 USD contract, the biggest the franchise had ever given out, and about 4 times the league average at the time.
No wonder he had all that money to start up a coffee shop.
Oh, absolutely. This is him and his wife. So this is an adult Tim Horton, so you can make salacious comments about him.
I'm good.
He is still yoked.
I should maybe stop making fun of him for like how he looks, because I don't think that people should be made fun of for how they look, but... you know what? He's dead and he had lots of money, so he's probably, he can handle it. He looks like the Thing. Like, he's absurdly large.
Yeah.
And he's got that, like, protruding brow bone thing that, like, yeah, he's got that full-on goon look for sure.
Unfortunately for Horton, age was still catching up to him. He was only able to play 44 games in the 78-game season, suffering a broken ankle and a separated shoulder. Despite his legendary Iron Man streak, he was no stranger to injury. Back in 1955, he broke his leg and jaw on the receiving end of a single massive hit, the recovery from which took up half of his season, limiting him to just 35 of 70 games that year. Unsurprisingly, Pittsburgh didn't protect his rights either, and he was picked up again in the intra-league draft by yet another team, the Buffalo Sabres. At 42, with a successful business to attend to and 4 kids to raise, cut adrift by an unimpressive team, and with a body that was showing its cracks, Tim Horton finally had every reason to finally hang up his skates. There was no Red Kelly here to convince him. There was, incidentally, a Punch Imlach, Horton's longtime coach, manager, and friend who had been put at the helm of the brand new Sabres after only a year off work. Imlach wanted a solid veteran presence to guide his fledgling expansion team, and their connection was enough to pull in his buddy Tim for one last job. Well, their connection and a renewal of his $100,000 salary anyway.
Jesus.
And seemingly he earned it. At the end of the year, he was named the team's MVP as the Sabres made the playoffs for the first time in only their third season of existence.
Most valuable primate?
Yeah. And I'm glad you said that because here is Tim Hortons when he played for the Sabres.
Jesus.
Yeah.
He looks like fucking, I don't watch Star Trek, but he looks like he's like an alternate race in Star Trek, like from a planet. And they've given him like prosthetics face, like for his face to make him look otherworldly.
Yeah. People aged back then. Also, I think, I don't know if this is like a comb over thing, but like he's got this, you know, we were looking at his like 60s haircuts before, like that Joe Namath, like that's a haircut you can set your watch to. And now he's got this kind of swept over like Lego hair.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He looks like you could just detach his hair. There's absolutely Lego hair is an excellent, excellent description. Yeah.
You might say that this would have been a perfect high note to end a 23-season NHL career on, and for what it's worth, Tim Horton would have agreed with you. Punch Imlach, however, did not. If Tim Horton wouldn't re-sign for $100,000, the solution was obvious. Offer him $150,000.
Jesus!
Yeah.
You just want 50% more? Here yeah. you go, buddy.
Much to his chagrin, though, even this wasn't enough to persuade the 43-year-old journeyman. So what do you think happens next? What would you offer to convince him?
Oh God! Oh, he's gonna double it, isn't he? He's gonna tell him. He's gonna tell him 200,000.
We have to take a small diversion to talk about something that really upset me.
Okay.
In the process of trying to verify Tim Horton's retirement announcement for each one of these years, I stumbled across a professional bass fisherman named Timmy Horton.
Oh no!
So here's Timmy Horton,
who
announced his retirement from the Bass Pro Tour in March of 2022. This leads me to the following column posted on MajorLeagueFishing.com on January 13th, 2023, written by Timmy Horton. And I've actually heard him speak, so I am going to do my extremely wrong version of his accent.
Okay.
Well, as most of you have heard, I've pulled a Tom Brady. After announcing my retirement last year, I've had a change of heart and will fish the Bass Pro Tour in 2023. I'm just not ready to watch MLF now from my house while these guys fish Lake Gunnersville in May.
What is this, the Horton curse? Like, they just can't...
Right. So here's my first problem. Well, here's my only problem is you called it pulling a Tom Brady. You should have called it pulling a Tim Horton.
Yeah. That's, yeah, absolutely fair.
Like,
I mean, fucking Americans don't know anything that happens outside of their country, though.
They sure don't.
Nobody would have understood the pull the Tim Horton reference. They would have been like, you pulled yourself?
Yeah. Well...
No shame in pulling yourself, I guess.
Anyway, every time I read MLF now, it just looks like MILF now, like with an exclamation yeah. mark. And yeah. For what it's worth, I can confirm that Timmy Horton did not return to the Bass Pro Tour in 2024. But back to Tim, the hockey player. It turns out only one thing could get Horton back on the ice for Buffalo. As a signing bonus, he demanded a brand new sports car, a white 1974 De Tomaso Pantera, purchased for $17,000, about the cost of a Ferrari.
Oh no, this is also, I think I know what's happening to that car too.
So this isn't his car, but this is what he had. He had a white 1974 De Tomaso Pantera.
Okay.
Some places were reporting it as 72, but after looking at a bunch of sources, I'm pretty sure that's wrong. And also, like, why would you give someone a two-year-old car as the signing bonus? So.
Mm-hmm. How much the car was?
$17,000.
Okay.
Do you want me to convert that?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, well, too late.
Okay. How much is it in 2013 dollars?
Oh, sorry. I need to go from 1974. Wow, that was a huge difference. It dropped from 137,000 to 103,000. There was a lot of inflation in those, like, 5 years. Anyway, yeah, a little over $100,000.
Okay.
Now, a signing bonus is nothing out of the ordinary. But in order to understand just how significant this incentive would turn out to be, we have to do another small tangent and learn about the manner in which Tim Horton liked to drive.
Oh boy. More foreshadowing, I see.
This isn't even foreshadowing. This is just like shadowing. We're here.
Mm-hmm.
This subject is apparently covered in detail in the 1994 biography Open Ice, the Tim Horton Story, but lacking a digital version or the time to order a paperback, we'll have to settle for this sample for an article by autofocus.ca. Quote, Open Ice includes more than a few stories chronicling Tim's driving habits. Tim Horton Donuts co-founder Ron Joyce recalls one trip with Tim where the car went so fast it caught air. Other friends figured Tim's preferred driving speed was somewhere around 140 mph, or 225 kilometers per hour.
Okay. Yikes.
So here's a quote. Tim was a good driver, but he was fast, friend Ed Securco told Hunter. When he had a chance to open the car up, he opened the car up. Tim's wife, Lori, recounts driving Tim's Tiger home one night after...
Oh, sorry. The Tiger is the car.
This was before he got the De Tomaso Pantera. He got a car called the Tiger.
Okay. I was imagining the I gotta pick up the Tiger from daycare. And then Well, that's fine still.
Yeah. Tim's wife, Lori, recounts driving Tim's Tiger home one night after a party where he'd had too much to drink. He let her have the keys, but since it was his car, insisted on controlling the gas pedal by putting his foot on top of hers.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Holy shit. What a piece of shit.
Yeah. I must have lost 10 pounds on the drive home. It was frightening, she said.
I must have lost 10 pounds on the drive home.
Yeah.
I'm
from sweating.
Okay.
I think.
I was like,
that's my impression.
She's saying she shit her pants? Okay.
Yeah. You get also Ron Joyce's version of that story later, and he says you could hear Lori screaming as they drove down the street.
Yeah, I mean, fair. That's so horrifying. Yeah, you can drive, but I'm going to push the gas pedal down. That's some fucking psycho shit. That's like a horror movie thriller, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, what a monster.
This brings us to the point in the episode where I give a specific date, February 20th, 1974. That evening, the Buffalo Sabres were in Toronto to go up against Horton's longtime team as the two clubs were jockeying for the last playoff spot in the division. Tim Horton, now 44, was again battling injury. On the topic of aging, a 2024 retrospective by Haggerty Media mused that Horton had joked that, quote, he might not see a puck quickly enough to avoid taking a shot to the head. Whether or not that was a factor, the previous day a shot to the head is what he took. Here's their retelling of events. During practice the day before, Horton had taken a puck to the jaw, which left his face swollen and bruised.
Oof.
Regardless, he wanted to play in Toronto since his friends and family would be in attendance, including his wife Lori and their four children. Early in the third period, however, the pain became too much for Horton to bear. Afterward, Imlach chatted with the All-Star while the rest of the Sabres boarded the bus. Imlach said Horton felt that he'd let the team down. He was hurting too badly to play a regular shift in the third period. We faded without him and lost, Imlach said.
Mm.
Yeah, all accounts seem to agree that it was a hit in the jaw. There was contemporary reporting that said it was actually 3 days earlier and it hit him in the face, in the cheekbone. Which to me made a lot more sense for how painful and swollen it might be, but there almost no other sources agree with that. So everyone says it was his jaw.
Anywhere on your face, I can't imagine it feels good to get a fucking frozen rubber puck going at whatever speed your buddy can slap shot it at.
The same article further quotes Imlach as saying, he was down in the dumps because he didn't like to miss a shift, and he felt he had cost us the game.
Oh.
All the same, despite the loss, Horton was named the game's third star. In this era, teams traveled together by bus. On this night, though, Tim Horton was an exception for several reasons. He was a veteran with a great deal of pull, he had his own car he wanted to drive, and the city of Buffalo was relatively close by. One of the reasons he'd agreed to extend his career there. Horton had his family home in the suburbs of Toronto, and the 160-kilometer journey back to Buffalo only took about 90 minutes or so, at least when riding the team bus. For Tim Horton in a De Tomaso Pantera, it could be much shorter.
Jesus.
Horton made an initial stop in Oakville at the headquarters of the company then called Tim Donut and spent several hours conversing with his business partner, Ron Joyce. According to Joyce, Horton left at about 4 a.m. and took off at about 175 kilometers per hour. I don't know how he's estimating it, if he had a radar gun or whatever.
Well, and also you're only there for the beginning of it. Does he just fucking burn rubber and just, okay.
Probably.
I guess, yeah. If you're driving 175 kilometers per hour, then you're probably not getting a slow start.
Yeah. We don't know how Ron Joyce would have made that estimate, but the distance from the former Maple Leaf Gardens to St. Catharines, hometown of Rush drummer Neil Peart, is over 100 kilometers and should take at least an hour at the best of times. Horton was reported to reach the latter at 4:30.
Okay, so sorry. Break those numbers down for me again.
So he left at 4 a.m.
Okay.
And he made it 100 kilometers in half an hour.
Okay.
So that's something 200 kilometers an hour.
Okay. Jesus. Yep. So just twice the speed limit?
Something like that.
Okay.
On his way out of Oakville, Horton passed through Burlington, where a concerned motorist called the police as he rocketed down Queen Elizabeth Way, or the QEW for short, And so outside St. Catharines, an Ontario provincial police officer was waiting. According to the constable, Mike Gula, Horton passed him by so quickly that he couldn't actually clock his speed or even the color of the car.
Oh my God. And the car was white. Like that should be, I guess it doesn't matter what the color was.
It was dark outside.
I mean, still though. Yeah. Jesus.
Gula attempted to give chase, but to no avail. Here is what he said to reporters the next day. Quote, I saw him go by and took off after him, but I never caught him. As far as I'm concerned, he didn't know he was being chased. I was doing over 100, that's miles, so I think that's about 160? Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm just going to say it in kilometers. I was doing it over 160, but I lost sight. I never got close. A few minutes later, I came on the accident scene.
There it is.
Gula's best guess was that Horton was traveling about 110 mph or 177 kilometers per hour. He didn't witness any of the action firsthand, but in his first on-scene description, here's how he depicted it in the conventions of written report shorthand. Vehicle eastbound QEW in passing lane left roadway rolled over in median and numerous times ending up on its roof in westbound lanes facing in a northerly direction. As you may know, in this era, the majority of hockey players did not wear helmets when playing, and Tim Horton was no exception. Similarly, most drivers at the time did not wear seatbelts.
Fuck.
Oh, and this also includes Tim Horton.
Oh, no.
Was
there anything left of him? Jesus.
Consequently, at some point during this maneuver, Horton opted to exit the vehicle while in motion, albeit most likely unintentionally.
Oh, boy.
Gula noted the longitudinal distance between where the car stopped and where Horton stopped as 123 feet. For visual aid in 1974, this was the same distance from the neutral zone faceoff dots on one side of the ice to the goal line on the other.
How many burly Ontario boys is that? Oh my God!
Yeah, so there's a rough idea of how far.
Oh God, so okay, that's a ways.
As for Horton's fate, as it turns out, even Superman himself was evidently not immune to a controlled flight into the terrain at 175 kilometers per hour. Gula found a faint pulse, but St. Catharines General Hospital declared our Clark Kent to be dead on arrival. In addition to the 24 years of accumulated on-ice pain, the coroner listed a series of career-ending injuries. Quote, extensive crush fractures of multiple bones, a vault of skull and base of skull, a fracture dislocation of the neck at the C2 vertebra, multiple fractures across the left ribs, internal bleeding in the chest, and bleeding on the surface of the brain and meninges. Interestingly, there was no indication of any fracture to his jaw. His sudden death shocked the hockey world, and the Sabres in particular. The recent retrospective by the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle makes the following lofty comparison. Quote, there are moments that may only affect you peripherally, but you will always remember exactly where you were when they happened, such as the day the planes flew into the Twin Towers, or the Challenger space shuttle exploding, or Team USA accomplishing the miracle on ice. For the members of the Buffalo Sabres 1973-74 team, there was the morning of February 21st.
Okay, I thought they were going to say that everyone remembers those things equally, but he just means members of the team, that's fair.
Yeah, when I was first reading this, I was like, is he calling this the Canadian 9/11? Like,
yeah, I was like, Jesus, like this is not the Challenger explosion. One like guy died because he was going too fast, but yeah, I can see like if that's your teammate and your buddy that would be something you would remember.
Yeah, it's still very funny to be like, yeah, like this was the Challenger explosion. Like, no, it's still one guy.
Yeah,
like if Tim Horton had like a school teacher in his car and it had been televised him going off the road, that would have been like the Challenger explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Or if a second day Tommaso Pantera had gone off the road, it would have been like 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
But these things weren't handled like they are today. Nothing was canceled or postponed. 15 hours after Horton's death, the Sabres hosted the Atlanta Flames at the Buffalo Memorial Auditorium.
Is it called the Memorial Auditorium? Did they rename it that before doing the game? Is that how they like, justified it? They're like, well, it's the Memorial Auditorium.
Yeah, you'd assume so, right?
Mm-hmm.
The coach, Joe Crozier, was the first informed of the accident and the one to identify the body at the morgue, as his phone number had been found in Horton's wallet. After pregame warm-ups, Crozier recounted to the players their last conversation less than a day before, in which a dejected Tim Horton confided that he thought he'd played poorly and he'd wanted to win the game so badly and make the playoffs. In this, the last season of his long career. He told the team, "We can't bring Tim back, but if we go out there and work, we can get to the playoffs as Timmy wished." They didn't.
I was going to say, this is only nice if they actually did do that.
Yeah.
But now it's just extra sad.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play this game and we're going to do it for Tim.
Yeah. The Democrat and Chronicle shares the experience of a teammate, 20-year-old rookie Jim Schoenfeld. Quote, "I thought I had a pretty good handle on it. I thought I was okay and I'd go to the rink and play," he recalled. "But I remember being on the ice during the national anthem and they had the moment of silence for Tim. It was strange. It was almost like you could feel the compound grief of everyone in the building and it was kind of overwhelming. I remember trying to play the first shift with tears coming out of my eyes, and I remember finishing the shift and going to the bench, and Joe Crozier came down and comforted me. He recognized the situation and told me it was going to be okay. From that point, I was okay. You never know when your emotions are going to catch up to you. I thought I had a handle on everything and could keep my emotion inside, but that wasn't the case."
What the fuck?
You can't be showing emotions when you're on the ice.
Yeah.
Can't be mourning your dead friend.
He's like, "I thought I had a handle on my emotions. You never know when it's going to creep up on you." But like, yeah, you never know when emotions are going to creep up on you, but maybe the day that you found out your friend died is the day that you can like anticipate that they're going to creep up on you?
Yeah, probably.
Jesus.
After the previous night's loss to his former team, Tim Horton's career total of games played ticked over to 1,446 regular season games, which would stand as the NHL record among defensemen for the next 25 years, and 126 playoff games on top of that. Including the single game in 1950, he appeared in 24 different seasons in the NHL, a feat matched only by four other players in history and surpassed by only three. His untimely passing was rivaled perhaps only by Bill Barilko's poetic disappearance as the most tragic vehicular accident ever to strike professional hockey. Incidentally, another achievement later surpassed by Latvian blue liner Carlos Skrastins and the other 43 victims of the 2011 Lokomotiv Yaroslavl plane crash.
Oh my god.
He can't just keep Carl Skrastin's name out of his record book. At this point, I know everyone has the same question. But what about the car? Well.
Yes, I also had that question.
Tim Horton succeeded in turning his $17,000 Pantera into a twisted husk assigned a salvage value of $500.
Oh, boy.
So this is Tim Horton's car.
Oh, my God.
Do you want to describe that?
It's barely even a car.
Yeah.
It looks like a car after the crusher gets to it.
Yeah.
The tires are like coming off the rims. You can't even tell what part was supposed to be the hood anymore. It's like, oh my God.
A crusher did get to it. That crusher was Tim Horton.
Jesus. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. So it was written out as $500 value.
Is that tire on the roof? Because it like,
it looks like I think like they piled it on because I saw angles from other angles where it didn't,
but still it totally came off.
Oh
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It was reported later that the salvage value of the car was $500. For comparison, the 6 8 track tapes recovered from the wreck were appraised at $30 altogether.
Sorry, I can't stop looking at this guy that's holding the tarp up. He's wearing, the hat that he's wearing is like the ANW Bears hat. It's like that perfect cone shape with the pom-pom on top.
Yeah, that's really good. Punch Imlock, it should be noted, never forgave himself for buying it for Horton in the first place. "I knew I shouldn't have got him that damn car," he was quoted as saying in a conversation with Ron Joyce the next day.
Oh, buddy.
Imlock, understandably upset, was asking Joyce to be the one to make the call to inform Lori Horton of her husband's death. Mm-hmm. He had actually gone down to a local towing yard to see the Pantera in person. I'm going to read from the Toronto Star again. Quote, "The motor vehicle collision report from Horton's accident reveals what happened next to the heavily damaged vehicle. The report was withheld from the public until Ottawa Citizen reporter Glenn McGregor obtained it and Horton's autopsy findings through a Freedom of Information request in 2005. And you can get that now. I have it. I have a PDF. It's
okay.
Very interesting. You can just have people's autopsies.
Oh, boy.
The report shows that while Horton lay in the morgue, his demolished Pantera was hooked to a tow truck and transported to Simpson's Towing Yard in St. Catharines. Students from a nearby school skipped class to visit the yard. More people arrived, trying to get close to the car. When the crowd swelled and became unruly, police were called to keep order, instructing towing yard staff to cover the vehicle with a tarp." End quote. The main purpose of the Star article in question was to sincerely address speculation around what had been done with the car and why, explaining, quote, "Many people assume a salvage yard crushed it to avoid souvenir hunters picking over what remained of the hockey icon's ride after the devastating accident."
Mm-hmm.
Further, quote, "While the nation mourned, gawkers wandered the median of the busy four-lane highway, collecting souvenir bits of glass and chrome from the battered wreck."
Oh, boy.
The Star wasn't able to determine the fate of every part of the car, although it does seem some pieces were indeed salvaged out, including, most notably, the engine. The Pantera's V8 was acquired by a Nova Scotian racing enthusiast who built stock cars, and he put it into a Mach 1 Mustang that ended up winning a number of races on the Atlantic Speedway near Halifax.
Okay.
But that, in the end, is just trivia.
Okay.
Really, this is all to say that Horton's celebrity created stakes around the whole incident. A couple of the sources used here refer to speculation that there was unwillingness to investigate, or at least report, on the behalf of the authorities out of some desire to protect his name and legacy. Initial reporting like that from the Montreal Gazette was very terse and dry. For example, it took a statement from a nurse in the coroner's office saying it wasn't clear whether there or not there would be an official inquest, but quoted her with, "It's a bit doubtful." The same nurse offered the results of his autopsy as simply multiple injuries as a cause of death. Even the coroner's report itself only gives, quote, "lost control of the car at high speed" as the cause of the crash.
Oh boy.
And for over 3 decades, that's where the story ended, at least officially.
So people didn't realize what had happened. They didn't know that he had, like, they knew that it had crashed, but they didn't know why? Is that what's that saying? Like, they didn't want to release any details?
Yeah.
Because he was a Canadian hero, question mark?
Yeah, I think it was kind of downplayed, like, as an accident. Like, it was in the formal report that said, that report was sealed for a long time. So I think most of the reporting, when you look at the old reports, just say, like, he died in a car accident. And even a lot of newer reporting, just like when it's just talking about like the donut shop and it's like, oh, anyway, he died in a car accident. Like, didn't say he was ripping like 177.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't always get mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, usually they say like police say speed may have been a factor or something. But I guess I wonder if his wife was surprised or if she like immediately knew that he had like, anyways, sorry, I'm curious, but let's go on.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Oh.
So the rumor mill, as always, churned along. But in 2005, as mentioned already, journalist Glenn McGregor got his hands on the autopsy and accident reports that had been unable to be legally released under Ontario privacy law for exactly 30 years, at which point the exemption expires. McGregor was able to formally publish the contents, which included some very pertinent information. This comprised some pieces already discussed above, like the coroner's description of his injuries and the cause of the accident, and Constable Gula's depiction of the crash, including the details that it happened on a straight section of road in good condition. It also covers the conclusion of a forensic engineer that there were no indications of any pre-existing defects to the car. Finally, it contained one critical finding, one that had certainly been speculated but never formally reported.
He was hammered?
That's right. At the time of the accident, Tim Horton was, medically speaking, completely shit-faced.
Of course he was.
While blood and urine tests did not find traces of painkillers, as some had supposed, and only negligible amounts of amobarbital, his blood alcohol concentration was a different story. Today, there are certain non-criminal penalties in most of Canada for a BAC over 0.05 and criminal ones for over 0.08. Even in 1974, 0.08 was very much the legal limit. Tim Horton's BAC? 0.17.
Cool.
This brings us back to Ron Joyce, his business partner, and the last person to see him alive.
Oh, no. Buddy... that guy, like, just let him get into his fast car hammered is basically what's happening here. I mean, like, not to put the death on that guy, but, like, probably...
Yeah, let's revisit that thought in a little bit.
Okay, cool.
But that'll come in part two, so that's the end of part one. How are you feeling about Tim Horton after one part?
I mean, okay, so I did know about his death. I recently found this out. I have a friend in Zurich, and her son is a... like, he has a band, and they wrote a song called Double Double, and it's about Tim Horton's death. Mm-hmm. Joe Abbott, if you want to look him up, it's a good song. They found that out Canada Day last year. She sent it to me, which was kind of funny because she's like, Happy Canada Day. Here's this song about this horrific car crash. And I was like, okay, thank you.
Yep.
It's a really good song. So I did know about it, and I, like, did kind of know that, but I was like, that's, like... To be honest, I wasn't all that surprised. I was like, that sounds like very hockey player life. The thing that horrified me the most was probably the thing that horrified me the most was probably the, like, his letting, like, having his wife drive but controlling the gas pedal. I was like,
that's pretty fucked up.
That is so messed up. Like, that is, like, something, like, if you were watching a movie about a woman who's finds out that she's in an abusive relationship, like, how it's like nice at the beginning and they're having a fun time, that would be the scene where you would be like, oh my god, she's in danger.
Yeah.
Like,
100%.
That's like she's married a psychopath. That is, yeah, that's horrifying. But yeah, the drinking and driving and the dying horribly, I wasn't surprised at.
So that's the end of part one. Do you have anything to plug?
Yeah, my phone in because it's dying.
All right. Yeah, let's take a break and do that. And I would like to plug this show that you're listening to. yeah. Like, subscribe, comment, send us money. I think by the time we publish this, we'll have a Patreon going. So support us on Patreon for whatever the bonus content is going to be. And yeah, tell your friends, join our Discord. And we will see you next time. Je m'en calisse.
Born Under Punches is a collaborative effort between me, Kelly Gomo, and a variety of contributors to create a variety of shows. If you want to support the project, you can do so by following us and our friends on our various socials. Check out the episode description for all the relevant links, especially this one, patreon.com/bornunderpunches. No E in punches. By supporting us on Patreon, you can enable this show to sustain itself and produce regular episodes. Join at the basic tier for expanded access to our Discord server, donate at an elevated level for monthly bonus content, or even fund us at the highest amount. And once a month, I will draw anything you ask me to on an index card. And hey, if money's an object, word of mouth goes a long, long way.
Blue, blue, what a pop. Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go! Listen, listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
Any sources used in the episode you just heard can also be found in the description. This content was primarily produced in Amiskwetsiwaskaykan, in the traditional territory of the Nahiwak, Nakota, Nitsitapi, Mikawe, Métis, and other nations, also known as Edmonton, Alberta, in Western Treaty 6 territory. Thanks for listening, and happy trails to you.